This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehias Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Our decades of experience have taught organizations like UNICEF that when kids are out of school for a prolonged period of time, violence against them increases. Girls' pregnancy rates increase. Now that's a problem we're going to be left with well after this pandemic.
That's James Elder, spokesperson for UNICEF, on the organization's call for Eastern and Southern Africa to safely reopen schools. Details coming up. Also, 10 African leaders are scheduled to address the UN General Assembly today. A gas tanker explosion in Nigeria kills at least 28 people. And rights groups in Kenya are suing the government over alleged killing and human rights violations by members of Kenya's police. All these and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The Switzerland-based Internal Displacement Monitoring Center says escalating conflict and violence in the first half of the year have triggered an upsurge in the numbers of people fleeing their homes and becoming newly displaced within their own countries. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
Around 14.6 million people in 127 countries have been newly displaced between January and July because of natural and man-made disasters. This is about 1 million more than in the first half of last year. The Internal Displacement Monitoring Center report finds conflict and violence have sparked around one-third or 4.8 million new displacements, mainly in Africa and the Middle East. IDMC Director Alexandra Bilak says Syria tops the rank of countries with the highest increase in newly displaced. She says the military offensive in the country's northwest province of Idlib has prompted more than 1.4 million civilians to flee their homes.
DRC, the Democratic Republic of Congo, that also has seen a sharp increase in violence and armed violence and insecurity, particularly in its northern, northeastern province of Ituri, which has also led to, as Syria, 1.4 million new displacements.
Bilak says Burkina Faso, with nearly a half million newly displaced, has become the worst displacement crisis in West Africa as armed conflict has expanded across the region. She expresses alarm at the rapidly deteriorating situations in Cameroon, Mozambique, Niger, and Somalia. She says growing conflict and violence in these countries have resulted in more new displacements in the first half of this year than in all of 2019. But she notes the situation of Yemen, currently considered the world's worst humanitarian catastrophe, remains of particular concern.
Although the numbers for Yemen are low, the reported numbers are low, we are highlighting the triple crisis that Yemen faces right now in the form of course, this ongoing and persistent conflict that has been exacerbated by high infection rates of COVID-19, as well as more recently some of the worst floods that the country has experienced in years.
Indeed, the report finds slow and sudden onset of natural disasters around the world have triggered 9.8 million new displacements. It reports cyclones in India and Bangladesh, floods and swarms of locusts in East Africa, devastating wildfires in Australia and the United States have resulted in the forced evacuations of millions of people in fear of their lives. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
10 African leaders, including several facing crisis ranging from deadly extremist attacks and political controversies to a protracted civil war, are scheduled to address the UN General Assembly today. Niger President Mahamadou Issoufou and Burkina Faso's Roch Marc Christian Kabore have been trying to fight a rise in Islamist attacks on civilians and security forces in the troubled Sahel region. Ivory Coast President has been criticized for pursuing a third term in office despite a constitutional limit of two. Fayez Mustafa Serge, President of the Presidency Council of the UN-backed Government of National Accord in Libya, is trying to foster an end to the country's protracted civil war. Also on today's list of speakers are Lazarus McCarthy Chakwera, Malawi's president and defense minister, Republic of Congo President Denis Sassou Nguesso, Botswana's president Mokgweetsi Eric Kebetswe Masisi, Guinea's president Alpha Conde, the Gambia president Adama Barrow, and Gabon's president Ali Bongo Ondimba. UNICEF is urging governments, parents, and teachers across Eastern and Southern Africa to safely reopen schools, saying the costs of keeping them closed, both financially and intellectually, could escalate. Mavis Ochera reports.
There are encouraging reports that 14 out of 21 countries in Eastern and Southern Africa have returned children to classrooms, with an additional 4 setting dates to do so. Countries such as Kenya, with a huge student population, have yet to decide when to reopen this year, compounding the challenges and risks which out-of-school children face. James Elder, spokesperson for UNICEF in Eastern and Southern Africa, says evidence shows that classroom is a safest place for children in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. He says UNICEF's advocacy on the issue is based on science, noting that children are the least infected and the least likely to spread the coronavirus. Elder says data shows children between the ages of 5 and 18 years account for 2.5% of all cases confirmed in Africa. He says having tens of millions of children at home is a learning crisis, with about half not having access to any form of education despite efforts by governments to provide online learning.
Children being out of schools also created a protection crisis. Our decades of experience have taught organisations like UNICEF that when kids are out of school for a prolonged period of time, violence against them increases. Girls' pregnancy rates increase. Now, that's a problem we're going to be left with well after this pandemic.
Elder says millions of children also are missing out on nutritious meals they would get at school. He says many countries have taken measures to ease restrictions aimed at curbing the spread of COVID-19 so they can revive their economies.
But most sectors, you know, from business to travel, they've reopened, and they've reopened because they're trying to mitigate the impacts of, you know, COVID control measures on their economy. But that also means that adults have resumed movements and interactions despite being the most vulnerable to COVID. So it doesn't make sense to keep children out of the classroom in that environment.
Elder says most children who are not in school in Eastern and Southern Africa are out and about in their villages and urban areas. So staying out of school isn't protecting them from COVID-19. He says reopening schools would also reduce losses incurred by both parents and governments and enable children to reduce learning losses. He says although the quest to reopen schools in the region may not be done perfectly, it shouldn't cause a surge in COVID-19 cases. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Ghana.
Nigerian officials say a gas tanker crashed into several vehicles after its brakes failed, then exploded and started a fire that killed at least 28 people in the central state of Kogi. Black smoke and flames rose into the sky as crowds of people watched on. Bisi Kazim, spokesman for the Federal Road Safety Corporation, says 9 children were involved in the accident yesterday morning, which happened opposite a gas station along the highway. About a month ago, South Africa's Health Department launched a mobile phone app it said would prevent many COVID-19 infections and possibly deaths. The COVID Alert SA app was designed to help the government trace people who'd been in contact with those infected with coronavirus. But as Darren Taylor reports, the app is so far unpopular.
The COVID Alert SA app is supposed to work like this. Once downloaded, it begins to emit a random code that's sent to the cell phones of others who have the app. The technology has the ability to determine if users' phones have been in close proximity to one another. Over time, each user builds an encounter history of those they've been in contact with. If an app user tests positive for COVID-19, this person then reports their diagnosis via the app. All other users with whom they've been in contact for the past 14 days will be immediately advised to get tested. The app sounds fantastic, but South Africans aren't downloading it.
I'm afraid to say the biggest thing is that people don't trust government and they don't trust the cell phone makers either. There's a lack of
Toby Shapshak is one of the country's foremost tech experts. He says citizens worry that the state will use the app to steal their private information and spy on them. The app's developer, Gaurang Tana, describes these concerns as misguided.
The app works completely anonymously. So for you to receive alerts, you don't need to do any registration whatsoever. The second comment that I'd like to make that should give people some comfort is that the app does not use GPS, it uses Bluetooth. And that really only measures proximity to other app users and not your actual location.
Sounds reasonable, says Shapshak, but there's a problem.
Most people do not turn the Bluetooth on their smartphones. They don't turn the data on their smartphones. A lot of people have very restrictive packages that only give them WhatsApp. They don't use any other form of data. And any tech-savvy, conscious person, especially, you know, in the mass market, are very wary of anything that's going to eat their battery life. So they turn off their Bluetooth. They turn off their Wi-Fi.
He says people also aren't using the app because they can't afford to.
The vast majority of people we know who have a smartphone don't have enough money to use data for the entire month, so they just don't. And if they only have a WhatsApp package and the Bluetooth isn't turned on, then it defeats the purpose, unfortunately.
Tana concedes that Shapshak makes good points.
We completely accept that, you know, your Bluetooth has to be on all the time. However, Apple and Google, with their operating system linkages, have made it easier to do this. So as soon as you activate what you call exposure notification on the phone, it sort of triggers you to activate Bluetooth, and then it runs on your phone.
This, he insists, makes it quite cheap to run the app. Tana maintains Shapshak's wrong about the app draining cell phone batteries.
Bluetooth Low Energy is the protocol that's used here, and consumes almost negligible quantity of battery power.
Many South Africans are also concerned the app will identify them as having COVID-19 and they'll be stigmatized. Tana says this isn't valid.
The only thing that would be made known to the person receiving the alert is the date of exposure, not even the time of exposure, so that the person cannot work out who they may have come into contact with.
Tana wants the app to be the country's fourth safety measure, along with hand washing, mask wearing, and social distancing to minimize infections going forward. But at this stage, it looks like that's not going to happen. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Gambian prosecutor and former Justice Minister Abubakar Tambadou has been named to Time Magazine's list of the 100 most influential people in 2020. Tambadou was recognized for bringing a case before the International Court of Justice accusing Myanmar of perpetrating genocide on the Rohingya survivors. He won an extraordinary ruling against Myanmar and its leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Also on Time's list is Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General of the World Health Organization, who was recognized for providing quality and equal health care treatment for all people, irrespective of age or race. Dr. Jean Muembe Tamfum, a Congolese physician and researcher who helped to discover the Ebola virus in 1976, was on the list too. Time wrote that his ongoing fight against Ebola has greatly benefited the world. Nigerian entrepreneur and philanthropist Tony Elemulu, chairman of the United Bank of Africa. Tuni Fonsho, chair of Nigeria's Rotary International Polio Eradication Program. And Tony Adeyemi, the Nigerian author of Children of Blood and Bone, were also on the Times list. Four rights groups in Kenya are suing the government over alleged killing and human rights violations by members of Kenya's police force as they enforced a curfew to stop the spread of the coronavirus. The rights group are seeking legal reforms and monetary compensation on behalf of the victims. Rael Ambora reports from Nairobi.
The rights groups Amnesty International Kenya, International Justice Mission Kenya, Haki Africa and Kituo cha Sheria says police use the nighttime curfew to violate the rights of victims at a critical time. Annette Mbogo is executive director of Kituo cha Sheria, also known as the Legal Advice Center. She explained the decision to sue the government.
Within the pandemic, that's when the government responsibility towards its people should be even higher than when things are just as normal. During this time, there was a much higher responsibility of the police to ensure that they protect as opposed to meeting violence against the citizenry. So we feel that the issues being brought in this case are unique in that respect.
The petition included demands for long-term legislative reform aimed at addressing cases of alleged police brutality in the country.
This is not the first time that these incidences have been happening. What is different in this particular case is that, one, we are not just seeking an administrative decision, but we are seeking a court decision, a declaratory decision from the court that spells out the importance of the police not using excessive force as they execute their mandate. Number two also is that we are asking the court to ensure that there is one particular department or a cabinet secretary who will be assigned with implementing the legislation that relates to protection of the citizenry from excessive force.
The petitioners include five family members of people who were allegedly killed by police during curfew enforcement. One of them is Hussein Moyo Molte, whose son, 13-year-old Yasin Moyo, was shot on the balcony of his house in Nairobi's Kiamaiko neighborhood in March. Duncan Diema, the police officer who allegedly killed Yasin, pleaded not guilty to murder charges and was later released on cash bail pending trial. Yasin's father says he hopes he will get justice through the trial or possibly through the lawsuit. He said, "What we are looking for is justice. I have not seen an officer come to me and tell me that they are on my side. I am working with those holding my hand. The case may or may not succeed, but the most important thing is that we are standing and demanding for justice." In June, the Independent Policing Oversight Authority, IPOA, a government institution that watches the work of the police in Kenya, said there had been 15 deaths linked to police action during curfew enforcement since March. Nairobi human rights activist Rama Wako says the number could be higher. She says, "We have filed so many cases such as this in the past. Yasin's moved fast because of the media attention and involvement from rights bodies. Because of that, there is a chance that there might be justice. But we have so many cases where we do not always have the media and others on board. In such, justice is always a challenge." In recent months, Kenya's government has relaxed most of the country's coronavirus restrictions and shortened curfew hours. Rael Ombor for VOA News, Nairobi.
Cameroon is sending hundreds of troops and police to the Central African Republic to protect civilians and build peace ahead of December elections. The troops under the UN's Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission, MINUSCO, finished trading this week in the border village of Mocheboom, from where Boki Edwin Kinzeka reports.
Cameroon is sending hundreds of troops and police to the Central African Republic to protect civilians and build peace ahead of December elections. The troops, under the UN's Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission, MINUSCA, finished training this week in the border village of Mocheboom, from where Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports. A Cameroonian military band plays in the eastern village of Mocheboom to mark the end of UN-led training for peacekeeping troops. The troops are to be deployed within weeks under the UN's Multidimensional Integrated Stabilization Mission, MINUSCA, to the Central African Republic, CAR. Cameroon's defense minister, Joseph Betty Asomu says the troops would foster peace for the CAR's December elections. He says they would protect civilians, election staff, their materials, international observers, and refugees returning to the CAR.
Le chef de l'État.
Asomo says besides the troops, Cameroon's President Paul Biya has made available logistical support for the Blue Beret battalions and two trained police units. He says they will serve for 1 year within MINUSCA. The UN has asked Cameroon's troops to help the CAR out of its security and sociopolitical turmoil by enabling citizens to rebuild destroyed institutions. Years of political instability and fighting between armed groups have displaced nearly a quarter of the Central African Republic's people. Since 2014, there were more than 11,000 UN peacekeepers in CAR, over 1,000 of them from Cameroon. Lieutenant Sekete Dibumbe said Cameroon's peacekeeping troops were well trained and ready for the mission.
The first phase was the general knowledge on UN system and UN peacekeeping operations. We went through the second, that was developing the individual aptitude, that was through communication skills, military communication skills, first aid, marksmanship, that's maintain and use of the weapons.
But while UN-led troops have helped establish a degree of stability, armed groups control much of the country. Albert Nseke is a conflict resolution specialist at the University of Bangui. He says the task for Cameroon peacekeepers is huge because despite an arms embargo imposed by the UN, rebel groups continue to acquire weapons. Nseke says the rebel groups intend to disrupt the elections expected at the end of this year to maintain their control of positions within the Central African Republic. The CAR's former president, Francois Bozize, who last year returned from exile in Uganda, challenged President Faustin Archange Touadéra in July for the top office. Bozize took power in 2003 coup, only to be overthrown in 2013 by Seleka rebels. French troops helped to defeat the rebels and ushered in the Central African Republic's last elections in 2016. But the UN says at least a dozen armed groups continue to fight over territory and resources throughout the country. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Motsebom, Eastern Cameroon.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Hey!
Hey, sports fans, brighten your day by tuning into the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1630 and 1830 UTC. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/VOA Sunny and on Twitter at VOA Sunny Sports. Or check out the blog at blogs.voanews.com/Sunny. It's the Sunny Side of Sports right here on the Voice of America.